Welcome back to Will Work for Purpose. Today I'll be joined by J.K. Rieke, who is a previous guest, and he's also an author, an illustrator, and a Christian, and that's sort of what we'll be talking about today. He's converted to Christianity in his later 20s, and kind of keeping with the theme of the episodes I've been doing recently, I've been interviewing people and how they came to sort of their religious belief system, whether they became an atheist, a Christian, whatever they became. So far, the only ones I've done are the past two, which have been conversion from atheism to paganism to Christianity, and then one that was a deconversion from Christianity. And we also touch on politics in that episode. But today, I'll be talking with J.K. Rieke, and we touch on a lot of various topics within Christianity, and also just sort of like the best way in which you can help someone find their belief system, or the way that you can kind of dialogue with someone who you want to convince, or, you know, vice versa. So without further ado, this is the 20th episode of Will Work for Purpose. Today we're joined by J.K. Rieke again, who's a previous guest I've had on. He's an author, an illustrator, and like I said, a previous guest. J.K., how are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me back. It was such a fun time the last couple times, so I'm glad we can do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we'll be going over your story on how you converted or became a Christian, whatever terminology you'd like to use in that domain. But it's sort of part of an ongoing series that I'm kind of doing almost by accident, really. Just kind of interviewing people about how they sort of develop the beliefs that they currently have, whether they're religious or irreligious, or, you know, wherever they sort of fall along that spectrum. If you could just start telling, kind of start from the beginning, what was sort of like your early childhood, your upbringing sort of like, were you religious, non-religious, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was fortunate to come from a Christian background. Pretty much all of my family were Christians. Some of them were more Christmas and Easter Christians, and some of them were a little bit deeper. But across the board, nobody really had a deep scriptural background. So I was raised in a church that was extremely loving and extremely close. It was a small community and it was great for that. But we really didn't get much in terms of the Bible. We got a lot of kind of self-help sort of sermons that went all over the place. They were very inspirational, but there wasn't tremendous amounts of depth. So I kind of grew up with knowledge of God, but it was a loose knowledge. It was God loves you, you know, believe in Jesus, you'll go to heaven, that sort of thing. But there wasn't a whole lot beyond that.
Mm. Yeah. So did that, I guess, sort of impede you early on, in the sense that, it's sort of like, I guess, the way I've always kind of heard it analogized, or, you know, symbolized or whatever, like as the idea sort of anesthetized you, or sort of immune, like it was sort of like getting a vaccine. Like, did it really make you resistant to Christianity later on? You kind of thought, oh, I already kind of know that. Or were you always just sort of like in that, what would you call, like sort of, C.S. Lewis might call it Christianity in water, like where it's just sort of like, not a lot of like doctrinal teachings and things like that. Were you sort of like in that sort of group for a long period of time, or did you sort of completely leave the church behind? Sort of how did that develop over time?
Yeah. So I definitely left the church behind. I guess before we get to that point, I could talk a little bit about the transition there. So while I was growing up, I was forced to go to church because that's generally how it works when you're a kid. You're going where the parents are going. And so off I was to church every week. I didn't dislike it. It's just, it was a thing that you did on Sunday. And as I became a teenager, I had a little more freedom, so I was no longer forced, and that's when I stopped going. But I still considered myself a Christian. It was still a huge part of my life in terms of just my identity. Mm. And people around me knew that. But again, there wasn't a lot of depth there. So what ended up happening was I had a lot of questions, as I think every young Christian and even mature Christian does, but I didn't have anybody to answer them. And that was a time when the internet was still pretty young. So it wasn't like I could just go online and find YouTube videos on apologetics and things, information. I probably could have, but to be honest, I was terrified because I thought, what if this is just bogus nonsense? There were so many things in the questions that didn't make sense to me, and I didn't have answers, that I was terrified. So I kind of put God behind a wall. And I said, I'm never, ever going past this wall. I'm going to keep God there, and he's going to be an important part of my life, but I'm not going to question any of it. That's the one thing I won't do, is I won't question. And that worked for a while until it didn't. Mm. And when it didn't, it really crashed hard because I had then gotten some arguments from atheists, and more specifically, I guess, anti-theists, and they running around in my head and just kind of played on those doubts that I had. And so it was like one day I just stopped. It was I couldn't keep this up anymore. I truly believe now, I didn't realize it then, and I couldn't put it into terms, but if you don't base your beliefs on truth, eventually they're going to crash. I just think that that's how it's going to happen. You might get through a lot of life with false beliefs, but eventually it's not going to last. So one day I just said, nope, I don't believe God exists anymore. It wasn't an agnostic thing. It wasn't a half measure. It was straight up. No, he's not there. There's no God. That's craziness. So.
And about how old were you when you totally were like, yeah, this whole God thing, not for me, and don't think it's real? About what time do you think that sort of you had that revelation?
It was mid-20s. I know that much. I'm not sure if it was 23, 24, or 25, but I think it was that range, somewhere right in there. And I remember, I don't know the date, but I remember the day. It's very vivid in my memory, the moment that I sat there. Actually, ironically, I was holding a Bible and just sitting there in my mother's house and just like, I can't do this anymore.
And were the people in your life, were they supportive of that decision, or were they like, did they kind of reject you, or was it sort of, how did they have that? What was their reaction like? How did they handle this?
Yeah. So I had, like I said, my family had a strong Christian background, or a Christian background, but honestly, my friends didn't. I had a variety of friends, some atheists, some Jewish. It was a variety of people. I don't know that any of them were necessarily that religious in general. My one Jewish friend was, but other than that, I didn't really have any religious friends. So I didn't have people in my life that were going to really care, I guess, about what I decided. I did talk to my mother about it, and she was sympathetic because she had been through something similar herself. She was able to sit with me and say, I hate that you're going through this, but I don't really have anything for you because I this is part of what you have to go deal with, I guess. She loved me dearly just as much before and after, but there wasn't any real change there other than to hug me and say that it was going to be okay, I guess.
And so I guess were your friend groups weren't really built up in sort of a church context, so you really didn't there was no one that sort of just totally shut you out and said, we're not having any more to do with you. That's good that, none of that happened. Whenever you rejected Christianity, did you become, dogmatic in that rejection? Did you all of a sudden flip the other way and you may have been a lukewarm Christian, and then all of a sudden you became a a firebrand burning atheist or anti-theist? Like, did you have that sort of polarization in you after you left?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. So for the vast majority of my young life, I was much more of an extremist. I went one way or the other, like, wholeheartedly. That's why it was hard for me to continue with God behind a wall, because I kept wanting to break past that wall. Like, it was just too much. It was too hard. But when this thing happened that God didn't exist anymore, and that was like my biggest fear for so long, it was all at once both freeing and, like, I don't know exactly how to explain it. It was very different, because there were no more walls. There was only 100% openness. So I just ran, and I ran in every direction that I could. And I started reading, and I started studying, and I started following things to the depths of their conclusions. And it was a really hard time, because I know this is where it gets tricky, because I don't want to offend anybody. And I know these are hard topics. One thing that I find that many atheists and anti-theists don't particularly look at is that atheism doesn't exist in a bubble. It's easy to say, oh, atheism is just this one belief, but it's really not. Because if you continue to dive into atheism, what you inevitably find is that down at the core of it is nihilism. It's this hard thing that happens when you follow logic, where logic leads, because logic doesn't care about you. It doesn't care about your feelings. And so that's kind of what I was left with. I was left with cold, hard logic that didn't care about me. And what it said was, hey, you are meaningless. You're just a clump of cells. Except you don't want to be that. So you have two choices here. You can either acknowledge this, or you can try and put it behind a wall. And guess what didn't work? Putting things behind walls. Mm-hmm. So I came to a real dark place right after that, where I was not only an atheist, but I was a nihilist. I was just, I'm like, none of this matters. It's completely pointless. You know, I can run after pleasure, but pleasure is fleeting. So I was very fortunate at that time to have really kind and loving people in my life, regardless of their religious background, because that stopped me from probably killing myself somewhere around there.
I was going to ask sort of what was your mental status at the time? Like, I can only imagine that, you know, you were maybe depressed, or, you know, I mean, if you could speak to that, what going through all those arguments, and sort of like, I had this sort of a similar experience, like, as I was coming to Christianity, where, it was like, in the morning I was a Christian, and I was reading loads and loads of books. And so then I would say, by dinner time I was an atheist. And then by the time I laid my head down at the pillow, I was a Christian again. You know, like, it was like one of those things where it was like oscillating, because I was like, I'd read something by someone really smart, you know, and I'd be like, okay, well, that guy is like, he has an IQ of 180. He has, you know, 10 degree, like, he's so smart, and he thinks that God does not exist. And then I'd read something equal from someone equally as smart on the other side of the aisle. It says God does exist, and that it's the Christian God. And I'm like, oh man, like, this is so, you know, the oscillation was stressful. But you know, it sounds like at this point you were in one camp. And were you just reading sort of one vein of books? And, like, you know, was it sort of, I guess you said that you were almost suicidal. So was it sort of like affecting your mental health negatively? Like, were you drawing the connection? Like, these beliefs that I'm holding are destroying my health, essentially. Like,
yeah. So that's a tricky bit of business, because on the one hand, initially it was very negative. It was very depressed, but then you almost come past that part where you stop thinking that anything is negative, because that's nihilism. Nihilism mm-hmm. says, nothing matters, nothing is true, nothing is anything. So I kind of wasn't depressed anymore. I was just nothing, which is probably the worst depression you can get. But you can't really categorize it as depression, because depression says, you know, there's this bad thing. For me, it was, there's nothing bad, but there's also nothing good. So why? Like, what difference does anything? At that point, yes, I would definitely say that I was reading just, I wasn't even reading stuff that was anti-Christian or anti-religious. Hmm. I was just following logic. Like, whatever it was, I didn't care about arguments for or against. I just wanted to, at that point, know what was true. And like I said, that's when logic said, okay, if you're going to be an atheist, these are your two options. So which is it going to be? And I couldn't go back to pretending. Like, it just, I couldn't do it. It was too much for me. So I just said, all right, then nothing matters. And that's when it got, I guess, interesting, because when nothing mattered, it just didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And I had to deal with the fact that, okay, even if it doesn't make sense to me and it's true, then it has to be true. But if you look around, human life is not built for nihilism. Like, it just doesn't work. It's not functional. And so I started to say, okay, if it's not functional, if it literally just can't function with humanity, then there's probably something else that I need to at least explore. And so that's when I started kind of next steps, which was exploring more widely than just cold hard logic, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of came to this, your fascination or your sort of obsession with logic, was that something that sort of was with you your whole life? Were you always sort of in that vein, or did that develop over time? Like, was there someone in your life that sort of made you start thinking in those terms? Like, because I know for me, I used to, like, in my pre-Christian life, I abhorred, I didn't know what a syllogism was, or, you know, I didn't know how prepositional logic worked. I didn't know anything about anything of that nature, you know? So, like, was there someone else, like, did you have influence on you in sort of that area?
Well, interestingly, I don't know. It's hard for me to remember if when I was a mm-hmm. kid, it was strictly logical. I don't think mm-hmm. it was. I think it was probably the opposite extreme. And then I flipped over. For me, I couldn't have put it into the words that I can put it into now. I say now, I was after these cold, hard logical proofs. Mm-hmm. At the time when I was exploring it, I didn't know what they were called. I was just like, I'm going to follow truth and whatever is true. So it was a non-intellectual logical study kind of thing. And so as I explored more, that's when I started to realize, oh, wait, a million billion people have been through this exact same thing, and they've been studying it for thousands of years. So then you start to absorb some of what other people have studied, and then you're kind of on the right track to at least learning some things. Mm.
And so when you said things started to get interesting, what exactly was that sort of trigger point? Like, what were the interesting bits?
Yeah, I you know, it's so weird, because while it's crystal clear for me that moment when I stopped believing in God, the road back was just a journey. Like, I can't pinpoint any moments in particular, but I can say that when I realized that, you know, after the study of nihilism, it didn't add up, something didn't add up, that's when I started just kind of reading broadly. So I looked at a lot of Buddhism stuff. I looked into humanism a bit. I looked into Christianity again, because I mean, I had been raised with this thing, and I knew a lot of people who believed it, and I wanted to know why. And most of them didn't give me good reasons. Mm. They'd just been kind of brought up in it, which happens for a lot of people. But then I started finding people who did know why they believed what they believed. People like C.S. Lewis, people like N.T. Wright, people who, like you said, were really smart. And they seemed to know something was going on here. So I started studying a little bit further and deeper. And I started trying to get an idea of, is this something that I want to keep exploring? Like, basically, I was afraid of asking questions my whole life. And then suddenly I had no reason to be afraid of asking questions, because basically the worst thing that I could think of happened. So whatever, I'll ask everything. And I did. And I started asking everything. And that's when you start to find the really neat answers to those questions. But you also have the difficulty where a lot of those answers you aren't going to like. And so that's, I guess, the next transition was, I continued to go to the church that I grew up in after spending time away. I went back and I found a really nice community there. And I wasn't really sold on the beliefs, but I really liked community. So I stuck around and we had a change of pastors. And at that point, I was like, okay, I'm kind of done with this. So I had actually become pretty involved in the church. And I said, I'm going to stick around and help this new pastor transition into the role. And then once he's in, I'm gone. I'm done. Well, it turned out that pastor brought the Bible with him and brought an attitude of go ahead and ask every question you can think of. Everything is on the table, you know, science, religion, politics, anything. I don't care. Because he was so after truth that he literally did not care where he found it. He didn't care what you asked. There was no offending anybody. And he got up there and he just went into such depth that I never even knew existed within that book. And then I started to see, oh my gosh, these questions, they have legitimate answers. And he was kind of the one that taught me that whole, you're not going to necessarily like the answers, but truth is truth. So kind of too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that it sort of reminds me a bit of like C.S. Lewis kind of talks about this in one of his essays in The Weight of Glory, where he kind of talks about developing true beliefs. You know, he says to work out all of your data to conclusions which only support your point of view is to offer to the author of truth the unclean sacrifice of a lie. And so it's like whenever I think of that, you know, and whenever I think about that now, like whenever I'm doing research and for my clinical psychology thing, like it's very important for me to not, you know, manhandle the data, essentially, you know, to not make it, to not force it into a certain paradigm, you know, because like sort of like what you're saying, it's the truth is the truth in that sense, you know, like it's not what I can make it to be, or, you know, I can't make it serve some sort of thing within me or thing that I want it to serve, you know, like if that's what it is, that's what it is, you know, like it's sort of incontrovertible, you know. And so did you develop a close relationship with this pastor and like through this sort of like really heavily questioning, you know, kind of time in your life?
Yeah. Or? Yeah, definitely. I transitioned into the role of lay leader. And so we had a lot of one-on-one time to just talk about stuff, and he was twice my age. So he had been through a lot and seen a lot. He actually is a retired police officer. So he kind of got to deal with the worst of humanity. Mm. And so I think that really helped him because it was like, well, I've seen as bad as it gets, you know, when people are killing each other over stupid stuff. They're literally just dying in the streets. So there was nothing that he needed to hide. There was nothing that he needed to to be like pushing aside. If he didn't know something, he would just be like, yep, I don't know, it's a mystery, it's weird. And I'd be like, okay. And you know, we keep exploring it. It's not something that you'd stop questioning, but it wasn't like, oh, I have to have all the answers. There's just a lot of humility in it. And so it was a really great opportunity for me to grow by dying, I guess, because I was able to just start putting away what I wanted to see and just start looking at what was.
And so was it this sort of like purely intellectual pursuit of information and like this guy's like sort of humility of, what'd you call, humility of mind, his ability to sort of roll with the punches, like, oh, you know, I don't know an answer, but let's go read, you know, let's go do this, let's work it out, you know, like it's not a defeater necessarily, you know. And like so were there ever any other hang-ups with Christianity for you other than the intellectual ones? Like, I know for me, there were a lot of like, I had a lot of like early on moral qualms, you know, like there are a lot of things that I couldn't reconcile, I couldn't piece together. Did you have any other sort of like objections or reservations towards Christianity other than the purely sort of like logical ones?
Yeah, no, I think that even today, you know, most of my objections to Christianity are emotional. I've gotten past most of the logical ones because they end up essentially the biggest logical arguments against Christianity end up being emotional arguments. And it's hard to tell sometimes because we really want to, especially now in our age, we really want to be logical. We really want to be intellectual. We don't want, like, it's almost a sin to be too emotional, right? Mm. But if you chase those logical arguments down the holes, eventually you wind up with something pretty emotional, like, I don't like that God did that. Mm. I don't particularly care for whether the flood account is literal or allegorical. I don't like it. I mean, I don't like it. I don't right. like that Christ had to be, you know, nailed up on a cross. That's not, I'm not a fan. And then there's the stuff that is not so hard and horrible on God's side, like love your enemies. That's mm-hmm. one of my hardest ones. Like, I don't want to love my enemies, to be perfectly honest with you. I would rather hate them. It's easier for me to hate them, but God says no. And so pretty much all of my quote unquote problems with Christianity at this point are emotional problems. Mm-hmm. And then it comes back around to that logic aspect where I have to say to myself, okay, now what? Are you going to say it's my way or the highway? Or are you going to accept what appears to be true, even if you don't like it? It reminds me of the C.S. Lewis quote where he talks about faith being what you've already reasoned out in spite of mm-hmm. your changing emotions, right?
Yeah.
So every time I come to one of those moments where I'm just like, ah, I hate this. And the other big one for me that constantly comes up is cancer. I freaking hate it so much. And every time somebody new gets it, I'm like, Lord, I hate this. Why is this thing doing this?
Yeah.
And so ultimately that's where I struggle the most. And it's only through all of the studying that I've done and all of the reasoning that I've done that I can come out the other side and trust. Because ultimately, yeah. that's what I've got right now. Like, I have to trust. I don't have another option. I mean, I do. I could just run away from it. But those are kind of the two options you got left.
Yeah. Does it help you that you've sort of tasted the other side in some sense? I know a lot of people grew up with Christianity or grew up as Christians. That's all they ever known. And they may have been considered lukewarm, but then they stayed in the church, never left the church, and eventually developed a true they sort of owned their own beliefs and it really grew into it. And sometimes they wonder, you know, if I tell my story to someone like that, they always think something like, oh, wow, I don't really have a story like that. Like, and sometimes I almost feel that it sows a seed of doubt in some sense where like, maybe I should go try the other side for a little while and, you know, make sure that, you know, I'm picking the right team in some sense or the right set of beliefs, you know, like, do you think that it does help having that prior experience sort of walking the other side of the line?
Yeah, I think that it kind of goes both ways, like you said, because there are people who don't have to do what I did, who maybe don't have to do what you did. There are people who God can reach in other ways. It reminds me always of the passage from Thomas, right? Thomas doubted and he kept doubting and just kept and kept. And I feel bad for Thomas because that's the only thing we know him for. And he's, you know, mm-hmm. a great disciple. But Jesus eventually came to him and said, here's my hand, you know, put your finger in the hole in my hand and look at my side. And Thomas says, okay, I believe. And Jesus says, I'm glad that you believe now, but even more blessed are the people who didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kills me as somebody who had to be like Thomas, because mm-hmm. I realized that, you know, if I'd have started with the questions, I might not have had that same journey. It was the ignoring the questions that brought me to the point that I did. Yeah. That being said, I am thankful every day that God took me through that journey, because I wouldn't be me without it. It was a miserable nightmare. It was hell on earth to be a nihilist, like a hardcore nihilist. I think that a lot of people call themselves nihilists, but man, when you walk into that pit, it is not something to mess around with. But I would take that hell for the heaven that came after, because it's just glory. It's just so good. I don't have words for it.
I agree with you. And those sharing those sentiments, you know, like likewise, my story is something that I really wouldn't trade, despite how often I would have traded it while I was living it, you know. And I'm still living it, you know. I'm 25, you know, so there's still a lot of story left to live, presumably, you know, who knows. But it's, you know, and I hear a lot of Christians sort of sharing similar sentiments towards their story. You know, like one famous one that comes to mind is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who like wrote the Gulag Archipelago and won a Nobel Literature Prize for it. And in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, he says something similar. He says, I say to the surprise of my comrades around me, bless you, prison, for on your rotting prison mat straw, there I learned the secret of life, not that it's material gain or success, but rather for the maturation of the human soul. And he became a Christian in the gulags, you know. And he blesses all, you know, the gulags. If you read the Gulag Archipelago, which I recommend, I don't recommend the whole thing, but the abridged version, I definitely recommend everybody reads that. And when he describes what happens in those gulags, you know, it's like, how could anybody ever be blessing any amount of time experience, you know, lived in one of those camps? It's one of those things that's like, flies in the face of what might be assumed to be like common sense or reason, you know.
And it's definitely one of those things that when you've gone through it, like from the outside, you just can't quite, I can't even express it. And that's one of the hardest things for me now, is trying to talk to people who haven't gone through that, to try and explain how, man, it was worth it, but it was miserable. Just a nightmare.
And once you became a Christian, once you had that revelation, did you in what way did your life change? Like, did you become more intentional? Did you become more happy? Like, what were some of the things that you noticed? Sort of. I mean, I know you can't pinpoint sort of, but like maybe along that gradient of conversion, you know, like what were some of the things that started to change for you?
Well, I've generally always been a pretty positive, happy person, but there was always a cynicism in me, like just always throughout my whole life. There's just this underlying sarcasm and cynicism. And so once the peace came from knowing truth and trying to adhere to it, there was just a calmness that definitely increased. I didn't even necessarily say that there was an increase in happiness, but there was an increase in clarity, and there was an increase in just joy and peace of life, because I was able to just relax. And I always pretended to not care what other people thought. And after I learned, and I really learned and was shown that God loves me as much as he does, I legitimately didn't care anymore. I didn't have to pretend. There was no more pretending. That's, I guess, the biggest change. It went from a life where I had to be on all the time and act like X, Y, and Z to, oh my gosh, I can just be myself and it's totally fine. And, you know, before we started recording, we mentioned that if I said something or slipped up and I didn't want it said, I could edit it out, or you could edit it out. And I said, no, you probably aren't going to need to, because my life is about truth now. So what I say, I say. And it's beautiful and it's brilliant. And I wish it for everyone in the world to have that peace and that ability to just be like, oh, okay, we can do this. Let's just go do it.
Mm. To be yourself, genuinely yourself. And in my last conversation, or not my last one, but the one I had with this guy named Julian, he runs a blog called Coffee with Kierkegaard. And he kind of mentioned that as well, in terms of, I shared a bit of my story with him, and he pointed out something which I had really never thought about. But now that he sort of made it known to me, it might be something that's interesting to point out here, where essentially what happened when I became a Christian is I was humanized, where I, you know, I didn't have a developed self, and I didn't feel human in the sense that, one, I really wasn't treated so much as a human in my daily life, because I was a relatively mute kid and things like that, and just like mentally ill and things, you know, sort of on the fringe of society in that sense, you know. And it was Christians and Christianity and Christ himself that sort of humanized me and gave me a self and made me human in some sense. Like I couldn't, there was no way for me to actualize myself prior to my conversion, you know. And this is like one of those things that's touchy to say, because like obviously like I don't think, you know, there are people who can still actualize their gifts. There are plenty of secular people who are, you know, great artists, poets, writers, physicists, teachers, et cetera, you know, like, but for me in particular, for whatever reason, maybe a bent of character, or I, you know, or something to do with my digestion, maybe, who knows why, but for me in particular, you know, it took that event, that moment for me to gain all those things and to be able to self-actualize in any capacity, you know. And so it was like interesting to hear you say sort of a similar thing, you know, where it was like, well, I could be myself, I could be JK, I could be me, you know, I could be in my own skin, I could just be. And so, you know, that's an interesting phenomenon, you know, because I think that maybe is a lot of people sort of share similar sentiments, you know, like they weren't able to be until, you know. And I do hear, you know, I talked with in the deconversion story with Mark, he talked about he couldn't really, I mean, it wasn't that he couldn't be until he left Christianity, but it was that like there was this inner conflict within him until he left Christianity, you know, and really the whole sort of like that whole this sort of like westernized Christianity in particular, and like sort of westernized politics and just that sort of like Western mentality behind, you know. And so I wonder what's behind that, you know, or if there's any, you know, if you have any insights to add there.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I think that, for lack of a better word, the pseudo-Christian church is not great at accepting people where they are. And so if you're in that situation, you have to put on an appearance. You can't just say whatever or do whatever. And there's a lot of just having to play act, I guess, in that. So, and I was there. When I was younger, I often dreamed about what it would be like to be bad, essentially. Mm-hmm. I saw friends of mine who had no religious background, and they stole stuff and they got away with it, and they cheated on tests and they got better grades than me and things. And I always thought, oh man, that must be so sweet, because you could just do whatever. But I couldn't, because I had to be good. And I think that it was even harder when I was an atheist for a while, because then I had to extra be good, because
you had to prove everybody wrong about atheists, maybe.
Well, not even that. It was just that the world really wants you to act a certain way. I mean, the world is, and it's just gotten worse. And well, yeah, I guess I'd use the word worse. It's gotten heavier as time has gone on. Now we live in a time when it's like, you better agree with these people or else you're going to get just wrecked. And the division is so huge now. But it was that sort of thing, you know, in the secular world too. I had to be a certain person. I had to act a certain way. And you can't say certain things. You can't do certain things in both of those situations. And so the difference that happened for me, and I guess what you're saying too, is you were able to find a space where now it was like there wasn't any of that. Like the curtain's down, right? There's no more side stage where you get changed. There's just everything, and it is what it is. And you could just be.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, I've noticed a lot more and more, as you're saying there, like I used to stray from like best, better, worst, that sort of terminology. But, you know, what I have noticed is there's sort of a modernized version of sort of the high priest regime or something like that. Like the Pharisees of old have come back to plague our land anew, to a more mobilized degree, maybe, you know, like, so like now there's like, there's like stringent, a lot more stringency, you know, like if I'm in a classroom, like it, there are like, at least my university in particular, you know, like it's, there are the code of laws, you know, the guidelines, rules, and code of ethics that are both implicit and explicit in that room far outnumber, you know, biblical command in a lot of ways. You know, like there are a lot more bindings on me in that kind of environment, and even in like general social environments, you know, like, or in, you know, upon entering other businesses and things like that. Like there's a lot of, you can almost, the number of rules and regulations and checks put on someone's identity are almost palpable. You can almost feel them in the air. There's so many of them, you know, just in general, whether you're religious or not religious, you know, like in both environments. I would expect to see something like that, you know, given what I think about the world, you know, like given my Christian paradigm, I would expect to feel the principalities and powers of the air, you know, sort of like almost palpably, you know.
And I would say that, you know, it's definitely one thing when you agree with most of them, right? Mm-hmm. Because then you don't feel it near as harshly. And yeah. That's one of the beauties of truth, because truth will let you get out of that little bubble you're in. It will let you look at it and say, oh my gosh, yeah, this is crazy, like how crushing all of these unspoken rules are. But when you agree with most of the unspoken mm-hmm. rules, then you're like, oh no, it's fine. It's super open, and anybody can say whatever they want, which is obviously not true.
Right. It reminds me a little bit about, if you ever have or get the chance to read Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, there's this famous passage, even if you don't read the whole book, this little passage is like maybe a page or two long. It's called the Grand Inquisitor, and essentially it's, you know, I think it's during the Crusades, and Christ comes back to earth. Dostoevsky writes this fictitious story. Christ comes back to earth, and an inquisitor, the church captures him, and the inquisitor has words with him in a jail cell and says something like, look, you dignified man too much. You gave him freedom, but he prefers bondage, you know. And look, our church, we've been working for over 1,000 years now, you know, 1,500 years, and we really... look, we got these rules down pat, and we need to enforce them not less, but more strictly. And look, man, humanity, they want this. They want us to tell them when to eat, how much to eat, where they can go on Sunday. They want this, you know. And Christ sits and listens. And the inquisitor is described as sort of like an emaciated old man. Like he's just got pale, thin lips. His skin is old. And the only thing that Christ does is he kisses him. And then the inquisitor flees, leaving the jail cell open for him. And so it reminds me a little bit about that sort of interaction, you know, that idea that, the sort of the Christian mantra that Christ came to make men free, you know, that sort of thing, to free them from this sort of, from sort of, you know, social institutions to a certain degree, you know, like, to say that you can be an authentic self despite all of those, you know, all the pressures, or, you know, all the laws and rules and regulations and things of that nature, you know.
Absolutely. And it's interesting with Christianity too, because you know, it talks about the law didn't really go anywhere. It's not that he came and just tossed it out the window. It's that now you're so free that you can just want to do the right thing, you know. Mm. Whereas I feel like with right now, in a lot of, at least in the US, there's no freedom to choose to do the right thing. There is mm-hmm. you do it or consequences.
Well, yeah.
And so that's where the freedom, I think, really comes in that sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a difference between giving your money to the poor and then being robbed at gunpoint by a poor person. You know, like there, you know, and that's sort of the difference between charity and theft. You know, like it's like, yeah, you know, a lot of laws, a lot of regulations are sort of like compulsive. You know, and some things, you know, it's difficult because, like, in an ideal world, you wouldn't be compelled to do good things. But in some sense, I'm also glad that certain people are compelled to do certain things. You know, like, and we have a system in place to compel people to do good, noble, virtuous things. You know, like, right. And that we have a prison system and things like that. You know, like, you know, to what degree that functions properly, I don't know. I'm not qualified to say, but. Just the fact that we can have something like that, because a lot of people don't want to play by the game, by the rules, you know, like they don't have that desire to do what is good. And so, you know, what could be seen by any number of case studies, serial killers, et cetera, you know, like you can see that they desperately do not want to do the good thing, you know? And to that degree, I am thankful that there is the law and things like that, you know, but there is like that overstepping, that overarching, you know, like where your identity is compulsory, you know, like people are forced to be a certain thing. Like you must go to school for 15 years and you must learn these things because we think that these are the things that make a person or, you know, whatever criteria they judge the things that are taught in public schools by, you know, like I think that you know, and this is obvious, this is so tangential, but like, I think that's a big mistake, you know, like the way public schools are set up to create a certain type of person, essentially, you know, there's not like that sense of agency or ability to choose there. It's sort of like, it's compulsory. You will be an educated person, and not only will you be an educated person, but you will be educated in X, Y, and Z topics. And like that, you know, that's who you will be at the very least, you know, and, you know, some people, you know, I don't know, like there are lots of people that I've met that, you know, maybe they didn't need school, you know, like they function just fine without one. They don't act on any of the information they learned in that time period. And like, in many ways, they're a lot better than people who gained a lot more education than them, you know, like, so it's one of those things that's difficult for me to square.
It's so complicated, because what we're talking about is basically a system for everybody. And then the individuality of humanity, you're trying to fit everybody into something that will work okay for everybody.
Right.
And not only does it not work okay for most people, but the people who would really be exceptional under a different method will never be able to do that, because there's just no room for that flexibility. And boy, it's the same thing with the law, right? I don't want them to go away, and I don't want the public school system to go away.
Right, right.
But I also can recognize that it is tremendously broken right now.
Yeah.
What's the fix? I wish I had an answer. I mean, yeah. I guess, you know, there's the little bit of a platitude answer. Jesus is the answer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can say that. And it can sound empty. But at the same time, if you really look at what that means, you know, if we get our house in order, if we get our hearts fixed, then I think that it takes care of a lot of the other things that are broken because our hearts weren't fixed.
Yeah. Well, you know, and at a more, what you say, parabolic level, maybe, or like at the level of analogy, there's this bit where in the Bible where it kind of talks about a ministry being, you know, for a ministry to be fruitful, it must first be applied and be fruitful at home, you know? And I think it's one of the prophecies about Jesus that he would first work in his own, in the environment in which he grows up in. And like, you can push that one step further. And it's like, if your ideas don't work in your own home, like, sure, there are like, you know, there are societal reasons why someone might not be able to get their house in order. You know, like there may be someone who lost their job due to COVID, and like their particular set of skills lend them to a type of work that, you know, is totally, you know, decimated because of COVID, you know, and like that might be a societal factor, you know, like as to why they may not even have a house to put in order, you know, but there are other things. I tend to think of it more in terms of like virtuous behavior, you know, like I can't think of any societal reasons that would keep you from practicing virtue. You know, I can't think of any reason external to you that would prevent you from holding the door open for somebody or, you know, being a shoulder to cry on, or turning the other cheek when someone slaps you. Like, you know, I can't think in to that degree, it is about, you know, getting your house in order, so to speak, you know, and Christians and Christianity and Christ in particular, we weren't concerned with sort of material status, you know, like, in fact, the sort of lower you were on that rung, the better off, you know, blessed are the poor, you know. And so I totally agree with you in the sense that a lot of societal changes happen best at the individual level, you know, at the level of husband, wife, children, you know, father, mother, you know, grandfather, brother, sister, all that, you know, like at those sort of local levels, you know, that the world can be better impacted. You know?
And I think that, you know, at that level, there's a real chance and probability of change. Whereas, I hate to say it, but compulsory change mm-hmm. really doesn't stick very often.
Right.
You can try and force somebody to be a certain way. And I guess I'm a living example of that. Mm. Eventually it's going to break. It's just right. going to be like, I'm not doing this anymore. Right. I don't see a reason. And so you just...
Everybody has that bent where it's like, you're telling me I have to do this thing. I am definitely not doing that thing because you told me to do that thing, you know,
yeah.
Wash the car. I'm definitely not doing it because you told me to do it. Like I was going to do it before, but no, you know, everybody has that sort of rebellious vein in them, you know, like you can beat it into submission over time, you know, but like it's, you know, it's not easy. It can take a lot of time, or, you know, you have to go into the military or something. You have to have it systematically removed from you because it's just innate. It's like an almost an inborn trait. And I totally agree in terms of like, change happening on that interpersonal level, you know, because to sort of bring it back to sort of conversion story or, you know, the transition of beliefs or something like that. Like, for me, like when I became a Christian, there was no way that if I met a street preacher on the sidewalk while I was walking somewhere, if he came up to me and started to like hit me with his Bible, and if he said everything that I believe now, like in a way that even I would have found palatable, like if he was eloquent and like made sense and all of that, you know, I would have rejected it outright. Because of who he was to me, you know, the stranger on the street is moralizing. He's telling me what I should and shouldn't. There was just no way that that would happen, you know? You know, and much to my chagrin, to some degree, I became that person early on in my Christian walk where I became the sort of like, hyper apologetic, evangelistic sort, you know, where it was like, oh yeah, I'm going to argue with everybody and I'm going to convince everybody. And I have this Rolodex of like language and jargon and books and everything I've read over the past year and like all this stuff. I'm just going to slam it in the next person's face and they're going to believe. And it's going to, you know, it's all because I'm really clever. Luckily I don't have that now. Thankfully I learned all but too late about how to become, a light on the world rather than a blight on the world. But that sort of change at the interpersonal level literally took a friend of mine that I knew for 20 years to talk with me and to bring me into an environment. And like it wasn't the case that I just met some random dude, you know, and obviously that can happen, you know, like, yeah. But for me, it was at that interpersonal level, you know.
Definitely. I'm reminded when you were talking of something one of my favorite teachers like to say, which was, nobody preaches louder than the newly converted.
Yeah.
when you get that first jolt of it all, you're like, oh, I'm going to tell everybody. And then slowly over time, you're like, oh, suddenly, you know, the argument from divine hiddenness makes a lot more sense, because it doesn't work when you go down and you just start smacking people in the face. It's just not how it plays.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's especially it now, I think the best things that can happen are, you know, the public square is relatively shut down literally by COVID and figuratively by sort of like the sort of ideological background that we find yourself in today. So I think like the best place for change is quietly over, you know, coffees and coffee shops and in your home at dinner and, you know, things like that. I think places like that are where, you know, people will develop true beliefs and they'll, you know, aspire to be more virtuous and, you know, all of that. I think those are the environments that will, I think, see the most ROI, for lack of a better word, return on investment.
Yeah, I agree. You will. You're just going to grow so much more when you're small and growing together than you will if you're strangers and or. I mean, there's something to be said for preaching, but at the same time, it's what happens after the preaching that seems to matter a lot more sometimes.
Yeah. And to sort of bring it back to your story just for the last little bit here, we kind of went on this tangent as
we always do.
It was a good conversation nevertheless. To sort of reel it back a little bit, whenever you'd become, what would you say, newly minted, freshly converted, whenever you became a Christian, what were some of the most, when you think back on like those early days, what were some of the most, like, I guess you could call them arguments, like powerful statements versus arguments. What were some of the most like transformative things that you heard during that time? Like some of the things that like really were like, oh, wow, that's really amazing. Like I never heard anything like that before.
Yeah. So when the new pastor came into our church, he started at the beginning. We went literally into Genesis and he started just chugging along through there and just told these stories with commentary in ways that I'd never heard. And so from square one, it was so powerful because we got to hear about, you know, everybody pretty much knows the story of Adam and Eve. But then when you look at it a little more detail, and you say, okay, so Eve took the fruit and ate it and it was okay. And then she gave it to Adam and it was okay. But then God comes along and says, hey, where are you guys? And then they start saying different things. Just the fact that Adam's response was, the woman you gave me this fruit. And so he, in one sentence, blamed both God and Eve, right? Mm-hmm. And God immediately says, well, we're not doing that anymore. So I'm going to put you in charge of that household. Like, it's all going to stop with you. Anything that she does now is your fault forever. And so we're never going to be able to have that excuse again. And I like never looked at it from those perspectives before. And then it started lining up all the other stuff. You know, one of the things that always challenged me, both emotionally and intellectually, I guess, were passages that talked about wives submitting to their husbands. It was like, and that's tough stuff. I grew up with a very strong mother. She, you know, was a single mom for a while. And I don't know about this. Like, it's just as, but then you go back to the beginning and you say, the reason for this is not because the man's supposed to lord over her. It's so that somebody has a responsibility and there's no excuses anymore. And that changed my marriage, because once my wife and I both understood that, we were able to partner up in a way that we couldn't before, where, you know, if push came to shove, I was the one who had to stand up and say, you know, this is our family unit and this is what we're doing. It never came to that, because again, it was kind of like that truth sets you free thing, right? Once you were free, you didn't need it anymore. So things like that, I can't point to specifics. It was just like throughout the Bible, we just kept going and going and doing these Bible studies and really studying. Like my early life in Bible study experience was, what does this verse make you feel? Like,
yeah.
Stuff like that. And I think there's a place for that, but it's not Bible study. That's Bible discussion, maybe.
Sure.
So now, maybe. It's your, you know, personal discussion. But once you start studying it and you do like the hardcore exegesis and you start like uncovering the truth of it all, it's mind blowing because you're just like, wow, there's so much here. It's crazy pants. So it was really that did it. It was that depth. And it just keeps going deeper. I mean, I've been at this for like, 10 some years, I guess, hardcore. And it just keeps getting, it's like, there's no bottom to this. For a while, mm-hmm. I was legitimately worried that we were going to run out of things to study because I really enjoyed the Bible studies. There's no end to it. Like, you can't study the infinite and expect that you're going to run out of things to talk about. So
yeah,
it was really cool in that regard.
It's like an infinitely, complicates itself, you know, like the more you dig, the more complicated it gets.
And that's one of the things that astounded me about Christianity once I started studying it with like a more critical eye instead of the wall, was it is so unbelievably simple to walk to, like to mm-hmm. To enter. A child can understand God loves you, but you're broken, and so he's forgiving you. But then the deeper you want to go, it'll just be like, sure, come on, let's hang out, let's keep going. I got all the time in the world, so sure. So
yeah,
God just invites you to just dive in, and I can't wait to see what comes after, because we only really get a portion of it right now. It's right. Gonna be bonkers whenever we get to the next whatever's after this, because there's just so much that we don't know.
Right. It's a bit like Joseph's coat, you know, it's woven from the top without seam. And you can look at the whole thing and say, look, that's a nice coat. And then you can also look at each individual thread that sort of makes up, you know, the coat. And you can study, you know, how he made magenta, blue, purple, all that, you know, like this sort of like, it's one of those sort of like, I found that to be a helpful image in some sense, you know.
Definitely.
And so what if, so let's say someone is on their way out of Christianity. They're like getting ready to be like, all right, no more, I'm done. Or likewise, let's say there's some firebrand atheist or anti-theist or pantheist or agnostic or humanist, you know, someone from a sect other than Christianity, and they're starting to get on the trail. What are some things that you would recommend to like either camp?
Well, I think the nice thing is that I can recommend the same thing for everybody, wherever they are in their journey, which is just seek truth as openly as you possibly can. Set yourself aside as much as you can. Set aside your biases as much as you can and just look at what is. I truly and honestly believe at this point that if you go looking for truth, you'll find it. And if you go looking for what you want to find, you'll find that. That's one of the reasons I am so grateful for the experience I had to walk away from Christianity, because when I went back, I wasn't looking for what I wanted anymore. Like what I wanted and Christianity don't really line up. If I was going to invent Christianity tomorrow, it wouldn't look anything like that. Mm-hmm. And that's really like, it's comforting to know that I can just not want what I want and just find it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When you recognize your own confirmation bias, it's scary because you're like, oh my gosh, I can blind myself so easily. So as best as you can, person out there who is either seeking or deciding to seek elsewhere, just jump after truth. One of the beautiful things that came along with that is I no longer really freak out about people and other religions. You know, I get a lot of anti-theists who argue with me and they'll say, oh, well, you know, Muslims think that they're right, so that means you're wrong, which isn't really a great argument anyway. But I'm always like, good for them. Honest to goodness, if they're after the truth, I believe they'll find it. If that's the path that they're going, okay. I mean, I'll tell them what I've found, but I'm not going to tell them they have to go my route. God's too big for me to demand that he bend to my will. So seek truth as hard and openly as you can. When it frustrates you or when it upsets you, good. That means you've probably found something that is more true than what you want to believe in the first place. But just don't stop. Don't stop. Because I could have probably, like, whether it was my death or just giving up, I could have probably stopped and just lived a life where I didn't really care about anything. It's not worth it. It's not worth it to stop. That's why, even as a Christian now, I read so broadly. Like, I will pick up every book that I can on so many subjects, from, you know, other religions to atheism to whatever, because I just want truth. Whatever it is, I just want it, because it's the best.
Mm. I think that's a really beautiful way to end. We've talked for about an hour now, and we've covered your story in surplus. Where can people find more of your work, your books? You're writing coach now. Where can people kind of find more about you?
Yeah. So if you head to jkariki.com, which is jkariki.com, that's where you can find books, where you can also find my, like you said, I'm doing writing coaching now. So if you're interested in improving your writing craft, I'll just plug that. Sure, why not? Because I'm really enjoying helping younger writers to learn all these really cool things that I've picked up over the past 20 plus years. And just in general, I'm hanging around on Twitter too much, so you can always chat with me there. Thanks. I love coming on and chatting with you, so I really appreciate you having me back yet again, and I hope we get to do it again.
Absolutely, yeah. You're always a great guest, great person to talk to.
Likewise.
Thanks for taking the time to watch this episode of Will Work for Purpose. If you found anything here interesting, you can always leave a comment below or email me at mosley@tweakingo.com. If you were watching this podcast on YouTube, you can find audio versions of it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else major podcasts are found. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.